Hi guys, welcome back to the channel. And today we're going to be talking to a wonderful therapist from Burnley in Lancashire, who's kindly agreed to spend some time with us and tell us a little bit about her practice. This lady I know through a colleague of a colleague, so yes, really grateful for her to spend some time with us. And let's find out what she's got to say. Oh, hi Lindsay, good to meet you.
Hi, all right.
And thanks so much for spending some time with us today on the channel. Really appreciate your support.
No worries.
And obviously we're going to just have a little bit of a look into the practice as a therapist, and equally, I guess, primarily what sort of drew you into sort of therapy world, have a little bit of a look at your background and everything. So in terms of, I guess, good place to start. In terms of your background, have you always been a therapist, or was it something you came to later in life? What is your story?
Yeah, no, it's definitely something I came to later in life. So I'm late 40s now. So late 30s, I kind of started my journey into the world of therapy. Prior to that, I have quite a mixed professional background, really, I think, best to say. I've worked in sales, I've worked in marketing, I've worked in hospitality, worked in the care industry. So there's quite a mixed background.
A lot of skills, though, gathered from all those positions, I think, probably.
Yeah, I think that's been, just before that I went into the therapy world, I worked for local government for quite a while as well, working like on project administration, which is like quite a multitasking role. So it does feel like there's always been a lot of skill set that's been transferable, I think is the best thing to say. Yeah.
Okay. So that's obviously quite a, varied career. In terms of, I guess that point of, and I always sort of find it quite interesting, that point where one becomes interested in becoming a therapist. It's not really an obvious job to sort of go for it in terms of, it's something I think perhaps, well, I don't know, were you drawn to it or was it something that...
Not at all, if I'm being honest, no. So it's an interesting story as like, because it's one I've reflected back on myself, like what brought me to something that I feel like I was absolutely born to do, which is really interesting. I've always felt like I'm looking for the next thing in relation to careers. I've never fully quite felt settled through any of the professions that I worked in. And interestingly enough, when I left high school, they were introducing, which was the early 90s, they were introducing something called like psychological profiling for careers. So we used to get like this portfolio you left school with called the record of achievement. Some people might remember that. Within that, we sat down with a careers advisor and did this kind of strengths and skill set, etc. And it was a bit like a psychological profile in what would be known better these days. And in it said I would be a good psychologist was the actual outcome of it. And I remember at the time going, no, that's not what I'm going to be doing. For one, I wanted to earn money. So there was no way I was going to go into psychology at the time. It was more of a sales route I was interested in. But it's really interesting that those attributes must have been picked up at an early age with regards to interest in humans and people, I guess. So it was after actually a bout of illness. So I was really, really poorly after the birth of my second child. And I wasn't well enough to go back to my job in local government. And I wanted to get back into work, but I didn't know what I wanted to do. And I'd been spurred on from a retraining perspective by the last job interview that I'd been for when I didn't get the job, but I was told I had all the right skills. I just didn't have the right paperwork. So you need to go and get a degree in something. We're not bothered what it is, but then you'll meet the shortlisting criteria and actually you'd probably get the job. And I remember at the time feeling really frustrated by that. And I think it was very obvious to me at that time then, from an education perspective, that I wanted to learn more. I wanted to take my education a bit further than I had done as a child. So I knew I wanted to train in something. I knew I wanted a degree. I didn't know what I wanted a degree in. And I went to the local careers office where I'm from. And like I said, I was still recovering from an illness, sat down with this careers advisor and just started talking to them about similar to what I'm doing now. Tell me what your history is. Tell me what you've done in your jobs. Tell me the bits that you liked. And throughout all the careers that I'd had, so hospitality, marketing, sales, worked in finance, care industry, what came out of it was I enjoyed working with people. So I enjoyed the service, the customer service side, and the challenges of customer service. I always enjoyed working with people who had problems. I enjoyed problem solving. And at the time, this careers advisor just said to me, have you ever considered a job in like listening skills? Or, you know, wasn't necessarily counseling at the time, just honing that skill. So you're not necessarily problem solving, but you are able maybe to guide, I suppose, people with what they're struggling with. Or, and I said, no, I've never even thought of that. Funnily enough, though, did a psychological profile years ago and psychology came up. And he basically just said, there's a local level 2 counselling skills course going on at your local college. I need to give it a go. And I did. And then I stayed for level 3, and then the 4, 5, and 6. So that's how I got into the actual academic side and the training side of therapy. But by the end of level 3, I was hooked. I was absolutely hooked on this profession. It spoke to me on so many different levels. And it felt like it joined up so many things, my other skill sets. But again, there were so many elements of it that from a personal development perspective, I really enjoyed. I loved the challenge of learning about me and the concept of healing myself in order to sit with people who need healing. So that really appealed to me. Yeah, and I had a tutor who was really, really, not just a good tutor, but a really good motivator, and, you know, really practice those principles of being non-judgmental. Because I came into the profession with concerns around my own mental health of like, oh, I'm not sure I'm actually cut out for this, because I'd had challenges throughout my life. But I had a tutor who was like, no, that's what's going to make you a good therapist. It's that stuff that's going to make you attuned to people. And it was hearing that narrative that made me go, oh, actually, there's a different way to look at my own experiences, and I can actually improve myself as a person to be able to sit with others and help them do the same. That was the hook for me. I was like, where do I sign? How do I do this for a living? Can I get paid to do this? Really? It was like, I was in at that point. Definitely. Yeah.
Yeah. It's amazing, isn't it? I mean, what a journey, because it's, there's something about the whole sense of, I guess, your life sort of, you know, because even right in those early beginnings, you know, when you talk about the psychology, I mean, that's absolutely fascinating, that, isn't it? Could you do a profile on it, and sort of, it's like that really picked it out of you, but you've not formulated it. You went through those different experiences, avenues, career paths, and it was all bringing you around to that point of consciousness and readiness, wasn't it, by the sounds of it, just to realize this is it. And it, so it spoke to you absolutely when you got to that training. Which is a wonderful journey, isn't it? I think, you know, when you think about how things transpire and lead you to this point, but it feels very purposeful, your career.
Yeah, definitely.
In terms of the kind of training that you did, what kind of training was it? Was it what kind of model was it?
Yeah, so
something you selected, or?
Well, I just followed my tutor. So my tutor was running level 2 upwards and literally signed me up for level 4 without asking. It was like, you're doing this course, you're doing this degree. And I was like, and I remember at the time thinking, academically, can I do something like this? Because I'd like walked out of school at like 16. I had GCSEs, but I was like, I want to earn money. That was my, you earn money. That was the narrative in my family. That's what we do. We earn money. So I was like, I don't even know if I'm capable of writing essays and dissertations and, you know, and she was like, absolutely, that skill will come. Well, we can hone that, but you've got something that connects with people, and that's the bit we need to develop. The rest we can do in class, etc. So that course was an integrative counseling course for 2 years, and then I did the top up to become a psychotherapist. Again, an integrative psychotherapist. I'd say at its core was a person-centered model, because my tutor was a person-centered therapist. So it definitely had that running through it. And also from that theoretical perspective as well, like from level three upwards, a lot of it was based around, you know, working with Carl Rogers' theory. And, you know, also we did cognitive behavioral therapy, psychodynamic therapy, looked at trauma work, you know, touched on other modalities, but ultimately I would say it was person-centered what at its core. But what I liked about integrative, and what I still like about integrative now, is the fact that it's, from my perspective, there's a freedom to flow throughout the modalities. It's really interesting, because as the hours have clocked under session wise, and I've become more of an experienced therapist, I guess, when clients ask me, like, what are you, an integrative therapist? I don't like the label anymore.
Really?
It's really, yeah, because I don't think I fit traditionally into that model anymore. I think as it's developed over time, it's turned into something more compassion focused, and more explorative and curious than integrative models. Sometimes integrative feels that it boxes what I do in a little bit. So I push back on that a little bit, but I understand that is my core training. That is what I, you know, that's what it says on the certificate.
Anyway. Yeah, it's really interesting, isn't it? Because it's like, I'm sat here asking, how do you define yourself? You're saying, actually, it's a curious journey in therapy, isn't it? It's like there's an evolution in it.
Yeah.
You have a core, like, obviously, degree and everything, but there's something about growing in it as a therapist, and it doesn't stay still, does it, in that regard?
No, but, it doesn't.
But I was just wondering, so just to sort of clock on, I was just thinking, because I know you said about sales, because sales psychology, I think, is obviously the most powerful psychology there is, isn't it, in that sense? Is that something that you had to sort of, because again, when you're talking about person-centered, what kind of aspect of sales psycho is there? Some of the sales, because there is a little bit, isn't in therapy, isn't there?
I think there is in certain parts of therapy. I think we had during my training, we had some tasters come in by people who were looking at different modalities, and they brought in NLP, say, for instance, neurolinguistic programming, you know, and we got like this taster of, oh, this is what is it. And I remember sitting there and said, I feel like I'm on a timeshare deck at the time, because I've sold timeshare in my past, you know? So it was like, oh, you're teaching me how to sell timeshare. And they were like, that's not what we're doing. I'm like, some of those techniques are very, very, very similar. Or I'm sat in a car showroom. I can see the differences, the links here. Now, you know, NLP's got its place everywhere, and I know a lot of people, you know, clients have really benefited from that. But it's really interesting. I kind of rebuff that a little bit, because the sales that I've done in my life have always felt like there's never that pure, because there's always a goal, and the goal at the end is to get somebody to buy something, and, you know, there's a commission behind it, or that's the reality of sales. So I always feel like the only thing I could take from the sales from a purist perspective would be the connection and the rapport with the person you're with.
I see. I can see what you're saying, because it's like there's something about agendas, isn't there? And like you say, when you're talking about that kind of person-centered stuff, it's very much about that person finding the way to there.
And transparency. Lots of transparency. Which doesn't go on in sales in its purest form. But I know from working in sales that, you know, I've asked the question, what made you buy the product? And people have said, you, or it was so-and-so. I didn't buy off you, but I bought off so-and-so because I bought off, it was them selling it. So I suppose that connection and that rapport and that thing that isn't quite tangible between human beings, I think that transfers sometimes into the therapy world, where clients will work with a professional or a therapist, you know, myself as a client included, because there's something about that person that just sits or clicks. Yeah. You can't quite name it, but it feels like it's a be a good fit. That makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. And that that is a kind of, it's a felt thing, isn't it? It's when you feel a faith in someone, isn't it? You know, that it's a necessary part about it. When you're talking about trust building, rapport building, you know, do you feel safe working with someone? Because I think there's something about, again, sort of selling ourselves, our services as therapists. It's a curious line, isn't it, in terms of how much do we sell ourselves in terms of what we can deliver, because underneath it, it's can't really promise anything.
No, and it is an exchange. You know, if you're working in private practice, it's an exchange. It is a service. You're paying for a service. So there's always expectation in the room, because there's a service taking place. I think it's naive to think that isn't there. I think the difference maybe between newly qualified and where I am now is that I used to think that it had to look a certain way, or I had to explain it a certain way. And now with clients, I'm a lot more relaxed around, like, we'll just check in and we'll review that. And is that working for you? And if it's not, that's okay. And it's like normalizing that it's okay if something doesn't feel right to say that, and that doesn't necessarily mean there's going to be an adverse reaction to that, or you know, it's still developing transparency of communication skills, really. Developing my own, and helping clients to do that as well. You don't get a lot of that in sales usually. That's the bit that's missing normally.
That's the difference. But it's wonderful. So in terms of obviously that's the practice, sort of specialisms, have you got any areas of interest that you'd sort of like to talk about? Or
thank you. That has really developed over the years as well. So just to give you kind of an insight to myself, so I have a chronic illness condition, which is what I was off work for before I came into the to the profession, to the training. And when I was in training and first qualified, I was really interested in working with people with other chronic health conditions. So that lived experience stuff to me is really important in my practice. I think it's just part of who I am naturally. I struggle to separate me out completely from the therapy that I do. And that doesn't mean that I talk about me in the therapy. It just means it feels important to me to be able to understand on a different level. When clients are talking about their experiences. So I still work with people with chronic health conditions. But what that led me to in training is recognizing developmental trauma and complex trauma in my own life through the work that I was doing around attachment, and various different topics throughout the course, which is, you know, what we're meant to do. We have to kind of clean our own mirror in order to provide a decent reflection, you know. So that led me down the path then of trauma work, and I was really interested in working with particularly complex trauma, so adults that have maybe had developmental trauma or attachment trauma in their life, and working sometimes with children of adult children of alcoholics, or adult children of narcissistic parenting dynamics, all that stuff. The human behavioral stuff really fascinated me. And it's something that I ended up doing my dissertation on as well. So I did a research piece on, I call it the physical cost of perfectionism. So I could really see a link between chronic health conditions and complex trauma responses. And that became, for at least the first 2 or 3 years, if not 4 years, a special interest, I would call it, that I wanted to work for. So I did a lot more additional training around that, like professional development training, personal development training, therapy, you name it, everything that goes around that to make it a well-rounded professional, I suppose.
Yeah, I was going to say, and where, obviously, in terms of the clients, was it working for an organisation, this, or was this through private practice? Because obviously you work with the patients to get the experience of developing that. Was it Was it an organisation you worked with?
So both would be the answer to that. So during my training, I did three, if not four different placements, which is quite unusual. Usually you go and have a placement and you stick with it. But I wanted to get an idea of what I wanted to work with. Children being one, I wanted to know if I worked with children. That quickly was very evident that I don't want to work with children. I preferred working with adults. And I worked in addiction services for a while and, you know, tried as a trainee and quite quickly realised this is not where I belong either. And some of the best, from my experience, the best experience I got was working with a local voluntary sector organisation during my training, which basically was offering free at point of contact service to the community. So you never quite knew what your clients were bringing, really, because the service was open to everybody 18 plus. And I really enjoyed that. So when I qualified, I got a job at a local charity, and through their support, they let me open a free point of contact service counselling for them. So we got local lottery funding, we got a pilot funding for lottery, and then we got local and more established funding long term. It's in its fifth year now. That's still being offered in the Greater Manchester area. And I always felt a passion to be able to, one, offer therapy to people that couldn't afford it. That was really, really important to me. But at the same time, I had to live. So I needed that to be a job. I couldn't do it. I couldn't volunteer. So looking at them funding routes. But secondly, working in an organisation that wasn't necessarily traditionally mental health. So the mental health element is part of a bigger care and support package. That was really important to me as well, because there was a lot of counselling services out there. But I wanted the counselling service to be something as also supported by others. So say, for instance, you know, it's, you know, there's so many different things that impact our mental health, you know, poverty and familial impacts, you know, our culture. There's so many different things that can impact us, you know, our religion, our community. So I wanted to be able to offer a stream of support within a bigger package of support. And that's what I've been really lucky to be able to do. And some of the people that were coming into that service were bringing complex trauma because of their own backgrounds and their own upbringing. It's a lot of strong working class northern root upbringings that comes with its own complexities, you know. And then in my private practice, I found myself working with clients who obviously could afford therapy. And that was probably more finely attuned to people with chronic conditions or have experienced narcissistic parenting. And that's those kind of overlaps started to become more and more apparent really in my private practice. But yeah, two threads going on at the same time, really.
Yeah. Again, it's just seeing that you know, your background as well, isn't it? Because I think there's something that's really quite sort of creative and business-like as well.
I guess it is, yeah. And I think those, you know, previous skills, they transfer over from all those different jobs that I've worked in, you know, local government, and understanding the way commissioning works and funding works has made a big difference, you know, having that prior knowledge. So it's not been as scary when you embark on that.
Okay. So in terms of, so you have a private practice.
In the last 2 years, my practice has grown more than it was. So I've slightly reduced my hours through the free at point of contact service. So, but I still run that, but in order to grow the private practice. And the last 2 years, that has probably taken a bit more shape in relation to working with neurodivergent clients. So 2 years ago, I found out I'm autistic, which kind of put a whole new lens on my life of like, oh, this makes a lot of sense now, et cetera, et cetera. And being that person who, you know, will go and research and want to know everything about something straight away, which now makes a lot of sense. I then developed my practice into over the last 2 years now. And I'll probably say I'm in a position now to say this, working with neurodivergent clients pretty more or less exclusively, I would say. If people looked at the website, they would see that all the support that I offer now from a therapeutic lens is around late diagnosed autism and ADHD. Working with the queer community is really important to me as well, because there's lots of overlap in the queer community with neurodivergence as well. So working with those marginalized communities is become my passion now. You know, I think, again, it's that mirroring that lived experience stuff of not that my experience is the way that people experience it, but like, oh, I get that, what that's like when somebody gives you a diagnosis like 40 odd years later and you're like, what do I do with that? Like, how does that? So it's really important to me to be able to normalize that for people in therapy. That's really what I want to be able to do, is normalize that experience of that. Yeah, it's really impactful in your life, or can be. So now I would say my specialism tends to work with neurodivergent people, and they've, like, on my website, and where I seem to pop up is in those neurodiverse affirming places. So developing training and things like that as well, in relation to helping other mental health professionals work with neurodivergent clients.
Also, you do training for other therapists to developmental
Absolutely. Yeah. So I do a couple of bits of training. I'm laughing at myself now because there's so many plates spinning. So I deliver a level 4 counseling diploma now, with a colleague of mine, and that level 4 diploma is born out of the desire for counseling students to get a more inclusive and affirming training experience than potentially we both experienced. So it's a very creative, very experiential course, very ND affirming. So that's part of the training that I do. But bespoke to that, I also run supervision and neurodivergence, or just general mental health training, for organizations, mainly in the voluntary sector, I would say, but some in the private as well. So that's kind of bespoke to depending on what people are looking for their organization, really. But that over the last few years has taken off quite quickly, quicker than I expected it to, which is good, because I love being able to share knowledge and stuff. So
yeah, I was going to say, it just feels like you've got so much energy for this, and it's this, like you say, a lot of plates spinning, but do you feel that energy is fuels itself, kind of thing? Is it
I have to be really mindful of it. I have a chronic health condition and I'm neurodivergent, right? Those two things aren't the best thing that can burn, you know, you can end up in burnout pretty quickly. And I think, you know, I'm ODHD, so basically that means I have quite a lot of ADHD traits. So the dopamine hit, when it kicks in, I've got plans everywhere and ideas for this and idea for that. But, you know, the other side of me is like, whoa, hang on a minute, one thing at a time, let's structure it out. And one part of me is like, no, let's just go and do everything. So that takes some balancing, along with, you know, having a family and, you know, private practice and the other job, etc. But it's always fueled by the passion to want to connect with people. And I think that's been there right from level 3. Regardless of what I'm specializing in or what I'm talking about, that ultimately that connecting with people. And I think there's something along the lines for me of, I didn't realize, so there was something like that. When I came into my training, I realized that actually the narrative that we're given throughout our childhood and our adulthood, you know, through teenage years, school, friendships, media, parents, et cetera, et cetera. We're given this narrative of, this is who, you know, this is your limitations. This is who you are. This is what you're meant to do. Stay in your lane, all that type of stuff. I think as a society, we can be quite like that. And then when I came into counseling training, it really reflected back to me that actually all the things that I saw with deficits actually could turn into support and positive things. And if I can change the narrative on the way I see myself, and that's affirmed back at me through, it's working, you know, people are connecting to this, then there's something about me wanting to do that for others. There's something about affirming them and reflecting them. It's like a lot of people that I have met on my journey either come from that background of attachment trauma or developmental trauma or neurodivergence with attachment trauma, and have a narrative of, I'm broken. There's something wrong with me. I'm not good enough. Very, very critical, perfectionistic traits.
I was going to say,
No, it's all right. Come on, Ben. Go on. No, it's all
right. No, I was just going to say, so that comes with it hand in hand because of that. What you're saying, it's almost like an inflamed inner critic, would you say?
Yes.
Is that what you sort of suggest?
Yeah. I think there's a real, there's real substance behind the reality that as a neurodivergent person, you live in a world that isn't affirming. So unless you get early diagnosis, or unless you get that, you get a parent or a caregiver who's extremely affirming and supportive and educated themselves around neurodivergence, the world will tell you you're not meant to fit. It's you that's wrong. It's not the world that's wrong. It's you that's wrong. It's not the systems that are wrong. So when I kind of, even without realizing I was neurodivergent, but just through the trauma work that I was doing, the developmental work I was doing, recognize that actually I'm not broken. Like, the world's pretty broken and I may not have got the right support when I needed it, but that's not about me. That is actually about the environment that I've been exposed to. And I think once that switch went off, it was like, oh, people need to know about this. People need to know that actually it's not them. And you can change the narrative from within. And I'm not talking cognitively. I'm talking at a deeper level. Like, you can actually think, well, that is good enough. You know, that is okay. I can belong in a world that necessarily that I thought I didn't. And that's kind of what spurs on the passion to keep doing what I'm doing. Even when I'm tired, it's like beautiful. That reignites me every single time.
That's beautiful, Lindsay. I mean, it's beautiful just to even hear. I mean, to me, that's poetry, isn't that? Isn't it? Because it's like you're saying, you know, everything that you're recognizing in yourself and being able to, like you say, that drive to be able to teach other people, to have it in our consciousness, isn't it? This is reality.
Yeah. 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 You know, and the hope, the domino effect for me, the hope is, it's breaking generational stuff. So, you know, adults of a certain generation, particularly my age, you know, late 70s babies and early 70s babies that, you know, weren't necessarily exposed to mental health issues, or we just got on with it, weren't even exposed to, you know, like anything really. We just, you know, suck it up like that from that generation that have been brought up 40s, 50s and 60s of just suck it up, etc. So for me now, it's like, if I can help and support people to change their narrative 35, 30 upwards, and they go on to do that for their either nieces, nephews, children, sisters, brothers, etc., then there's a domino effect. And that's what I hope. I think that's when I had to nail down why I still do what I do. It's the kind of hope, as the world's a crazy place. There's no way you could take it all on and change it. But if you can just tweak the narrative for some people, that's life changing, and it's knock on to their next generation's life changing as well. So I often find myself working with people who want to break the chain, want to kind of change the narrative. They've come in to like recognize it's not okay, and they want to do, but like, how do I start this? How do I change, you know, 40 years of being told you're not good enough, so to speak.
I was going to say, do you find that obviously the people you're working with that they are equally motivated to break that sort of previous conditioning as well? Or do you find anyone sort of resistant to that, or sort of disbelieving in it in some way? You know, I mean, not really, because again, if someone's, you talk about someone's kind of core beliefs and changing that, do you get resistance, or is it generally the people go, it's amazing? Because I mean, just listening to this stuff, I'm going, yeah, it's amazing. Any resistance at all, do you?
Yeah, of course. I mean, I think with therapy, everybody will, I look at my role as a therapist as a stepping stone on the journey of somebody's life. So when they meet me, if I'm in private practice, people have usually found me specifically because of what I'm putting on my bio. And my bio talks about changing that narrative. So usually in private practice, people will want, there'll be a psychological and an emotional willingness to want to do the work.
I see.
Usually, yeah. I'd say 99% of the time. In the free up point of contact stuff, that's sometimes a bit different because they don't get as much autonomy in the fact that they get me. They don't get to choose what therapist they get. They just get me, you know. So, and I do, you know, I do work with narrative. So that's the way that I work, and I work through a compassion focused lens. So, you know, they're not going to get CBT, and that might be what they wanted, but, you know, it's kind of, you know, so sometimes there's resistance in the my approach, I would say. But I think the biggest thing I would say, I recognize it working with free at point of contact services, is you can't therapize people out of poverty, right? And you can't therapize people out of oppressive systems. So it doesn't matter. I can do the work so the person can start to feel better about themselves, but I can't change the fact that the benefits have been stopped while they get migrated from one system to another, and that's impacting their rent, and that's really stressful for them. And that reinforces some of that, I'm not good enough, can't do anything right, can I?
Yeah.
And there's the resistance sometimes that it's a whole, it feels like two different places, really, when we talk about the therapy that I'm doing, even though the approach is very similar.
And just to just say about the chronic health conditions as well, because again, that's just inside. Because is that long? It's usually long term work, or can you find you do people can come in for a little bit of short term work on that? Or I mean, how does it usually sort of present when someone comes in?
It's different for different people. I think I think having the lived experience, the difference with that is recognizing people's ability to and capacity for therapy. So because I recognize energy levels, etc., I'm able to kind of contract with people with long-term health conditions about what therapy might look like. So traditionally, you know, you have your 50 minutes every week, etc. I don't run my private practice like that. So I'm a lot more flexible in frequency, in time of sessions. I have some you know, clients who will prefer to work monthly longer. So I have longer sessions monthly or shorter sessions more regularly, because that's dependent on where, because the disability that I have is called a dynamic disability. That's the official term for it, because it fluctuates depending on lots of different factors. So it feels quite hypocritical as somebody who's got that condition then to enforce expectations on somebody else to be able to fit in with a model of like weekly 50 minute therapies. So I'll often contract with those clients and say, well, what works for you? And sometimes they don't know. Sometimes we work it as we go along. And I'm all right with that. I like the autonomy in that. I like giving clients the choice. I like that.
Yeah.
I know for some therapists that frightens them. Like, oh, I don't want to do that.
Yeah, exactly. But it's really important to know, isn't it? Because I think there's something about the nature of, so this sort of traditional, sort of old school kind of, be seen in that way, and again, so organizations demand that, you know, for business reasons. But like you say, you've got a great flexibility. What you're saying is you've got a great flexibility around sort of long term conditions.
I think if I didn't have it, would be hypocritical, and that means I'm not being congruent. So I'm not signing up to the stuff that I trained to do. You know, there's something about meeting the client where they're at. You know, and sometimes a client might have a frequency that I can't work with. I'm like, you know, I actually can't make that work because it just doesn't work with my scheduling, etc. But there's being open and honest and conversations around that. But I think I just, I like to, I'm laughing at myself, rebuff the kind of traditional being told this is the way we do it a little bit. One of the things I'm really feist up about this year is I suppose very normative health assessments, so things like PHQ-9, so the depression questionnaires, GAD's general anxiety, GAD-7 questionnaires. I'm really, as now a recognizing, I already had a thing in my bonnet anyway about being a chronic health condition, being a disabled person, but now recognizing, you know, that I'm neurodivergent, like these things don't work for me, because half of those things I'm an everyday all the time, like because of my neurodivergence, not necessarily because I'm in a mental health crisis. So I've been trying to raise some awareness recently about fit for purpose assessments, you know, and stuff like that, which again, pushing back a bit, I think.
Yeah, I was going to say, well, that's really interesting, isn't it? Because I mean, again, things are sort of designed in psychology, rolled out, this is it, and it's this is, I think you go to your GP is going to give you that straight away kind of thing. If you're talking about kind of any mood issues, but you're saying that you've got some thoughts that actually that just doesn't necessarily fit everyone. And in terms of the meaning of, is it the meaning of the questions? Is it that you're saying, or is it,
I think it's the lack scoring? Of exploration. Yeah, it's the lack of exploration that I found. So I get the question. I understand why it's being asked from a, you know, mental health assessment perspective and a very neurotypical, neuronormative, because if, you know, if you are depressed, your sleep's going to be impacted. Your eating's going to be impacted. I get all that. Your anxiety is going to be higher if you're anxious. In traditional clinical diagnosis of depression and anxiety. But if you're a neurodivergent person, let's say you've got ADHD, there's a very high chance your sleep will always be appalling, so it's never going to improve. So you're always going to score a 3. If you're autistic, there's a very high chance you don't recognize when you're hungry and thirsty. So your appetite's always going to be all over the place. You're never necessarily going to have, unless you're good at routine, a really good structured. So that question about, you know, have you noticed any changes in your appetite, was like, I don't feel hunger. How can I answer that? Yeah, I'm eating less. Are you eating less every day? Yeah, but that's not because I'm depressed. That's because I don't feel hunger. So the lack of exploration. So some people could score really, really highly and potentially trigger a crisis response, when actually just a little bit more unpicking around those questions from a neurodivergent perspective would lead people and potential mental health professionals to see it from a different way.
Yeah. I was going to say, so I can see what you're saying there. So there's a, Have you any thoughts around what could aid that,
what, or to do about them? Yeah. Yeah,
just, yeah. It's just more investigation into it. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I use them. So I don't use them in my private practice, but I do use them in the voluntary sector, because they are used for increasing funding scores. You know, that's what they are used for. They're an assessment, and they're submitted. It's very common in the voluntary sector, in order to get funding, that people have to see that the services are working, and the way they evidence that is to quantify people's mental health in a number. But that's the way it's always been done, so that's the way we do it. So what I tend to do is, when I have to use those forms, is I'll spend a lot more time, if I know that client's particularly neurodivergent, or whether that's self-diagnosed or officially diagnosed, just asking them what that means for them. Like when I say, do you feel, you know, if I just ask the question, in the last 2 weeks, how often have you felt anxious? And if I'm going to ask somebody who's autistic, they're going to go, constantly. It's like, oh, so you've scored a 3. And then I'd move on. I'd be like, okay, so what's normal for you? And that anxiety, is that linked to anything particular? Do you feel more anxious when you have to go out? Is it when you're around people? And a lot of the time it'll be, no, I've always been like that since I was a kid. Okay. So it's just unpicking that a little bit more, and kind of making them, I suppose, more ND friendly or inclusive or affirming, just to get a better picture of the individual. I'm not sure what the actual end answer is, better assessment tools, I guess, but what they look like, I don't know. Like I say, I'd love to, it's another plate I'd have to spin though, but I'd love to do some research into it a little bit more. But yeah.
But it's a point to raise though, isn't it? It's like you say, because it's there, isn't it? And there's a big question around the, like you say, it's one shoe fits all approach to assessing the,
well, counselling training is the similar, Ben. Counselling training is rolled out quite similar, you know. It's one size fits all. These are the modalities. This is what we do. This is how we do therapy. And this is how we train it. We tell trainees, this is what therapy looks like. I feel like I'm pushing that back all the time. Like, hang on, who says it has to look like that? As long as we're working ethically, who says it has to look like that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I think there's a lot, but there's a lot like that in life generally, isn't it? I think you just, when I don't know, stuff has been written about the way things are, and you know, you're thinking, well, it's written in a book, and then it gets passed down a generation, and we're all thinking, oh, this was like the law according to them, kind of thing. But yeah, it's real. You're really challenging that whole perception of just how, and it's evolving, isn't it? I think that's what you're saying. Everything's just got to evolve constantly, especially in therapy. You know, it cannot be,
you know,
absolute.
Exactly. Exactly. And ultimately, as long as the relationship's ethical and the practice is ethical. I often will say to the trainees that I work with, if you go back and read Carl Rogers' books or watch him in action, you know, he's not what would be described as a person-centered therapist today. He's more integrative. It's really interesting. Like, you know, he's open to challenge. you know, and his concept of what person centered as it's been developed into a training mechanism has taken shape into something slightly different. And that's kind of the stuff that I, you know, tend to notice and like to get people thinking about, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, wonderful. Well, it's just been an absolute kind of eye-opening conversation, to be honest with you. I think just about the sense of, I guess, like you say, the willingness to challenge the status quo in therapy, isn't it? You know what I mean? But yeah, at the same time, it's so progressive. You've got such a progressive approach to
I hope career. So. And that's what I think that's where I've found myself. But I had to go through all those hoops of doing it this way and doing it that way to work out, well, hang on a minute, to get to that bit. So, you know, it's got its place, because without it, I wouldn't have ended up here. So, yeah. Thank you for inviting me on, Ben.
It's all right. You're most welcome. And as a word, so people are, you know, because you work online with people. So if there was people watching this or listening to this, that you'd be able to contact you through that. Okay. Well, it's been great meeting you. And thanks so much for your time. I think anyone obviously listening to this would just be very warmed for what you've been able to share. But thanks again, Lindsay. And good luck. Good luck with your career.
All right. Thank you. See you later. Care, take care. Bye.
Yeah, that was that was wonderful. Wonderful interview there. And Lindsay's absolutely fantastic. And such a deep, resonant career within Lindsay's life there, and doing some wonderful work with neurodiversity and long-term health conditions. Have you ever been affected by any of those issues? Please contact Lindsay, and I'll put the details in the link below, just to be able to contact her if you want to do some work with her. So hope you enjoyed that. I absolutely it was wonderful interview, and hope you enjoyed it too, and I'll see you again next time.